We're about to have a conversation with Akiva Eldar. Akiva Eldar, for 35 years, was in Israel's major paper, Haaretz. He was a senior columnist, editorial writer, the paper's U.S. bureau chief, diplomatic correspondent. He's now the Israeli columnist for Al Monitor's Israel Pulse. The Financial Times called him one of the world's most influential commentators. He has written an incredible biography of Shimon Peres, co-authored the book Lords of Israel, The War Over Israeli Settlements and Occupied Territories. And years ago, was spokesperson for Teddy Kollek, then mayor of Jerusalem, and will be coming to Baltimore on Monday, December the 9th, for a conversation entitled Why the Two-State Solution is Vital. It'll be held at 7:30 at Har Sinai Synagogue, 2905 Walnut Avenue in Owings Mills, and sponsored by J Street Baltimore. More information, you can go to jstreet.org. Akiva Eldar, welcome to the Mark Steiner Show.
Hi. Good to
have you with us.
Be on the show.
Now that I have you on the air with us here for just a little while, the first place I'd like to start is back earlier in your career when you were working for Teddy Kollek, who is mayor of Jerusalem, and spent these years as a columnist and a writer. Something happened to you, it seemed, when it came to the occupation and Palestinians, that caused a real shift in your approach and thinking. What occurred for you?
Actually, it started when I was much younger. When I will tell you a secret. I served in the Israeli military government in the occupied territories before they were occupied, which I mean the Galilee in Israel was under military government since the establishment of the State of Israel in 48 until 66, just before the real occupation started. So I had the opportunity when I was already 18 years old to have a good look at what it means to occupy other people's minds, because it was not an occupation. They were Israeli citizens, but they were a kind of semi-officially second-class citizens, humiliated. And I realized that I am a kind of a win-win person. I'm not looking for any declaring victory. So I realized that this is not going to last. And happily, it ended in 66 in the area in the Galilee and in the Negev, which is Israel proper, and started in the West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem. Now, when I worked with Teddy Kollek, I had also a chance to look at the way Israel had to conduct its affairs in East Jerusalem, which means going back to working with collaborators, with kind of contradicting messages. On one hand, Israel is a democracy and it's all about equal rights. But on the other hand, I would say the official policy was, Judaization of Jerusalem. On one hand, it was united Jerusalem, and united means equal rights, of course, to everyone, to all its citizens. But on the other hand, you see with bare eyes the difference between East Jerusalem and West Jerusalem, between the Jewish new settlements in East Jerusalem and the old Palestinian settlements. So this was another opportunity to see that it's simply, first of all, it's not fair, and second, it doesn't work in the long run.
I want you to, if you could describe for us, given the for our listeners here, given the years you've covered this and what you've been writing, and you've become fairly controversial in Israel because of the things you've been writing, and in some parts of the larger Jewish community and the diaspora. But can you describe, from your perspective as an Israeli, what the conditions are for Palestinians? What if you had to describe what it was like to be a Palestinian living in occupied territories, or even being a Palestinian Israeli living in Israeli proper, how would you paint that picture for people who've never seen it and don't understand it?
Okay, I'll give you a picture that I got from a Palestinian colleague, a journalist, that when he wants to take his children to a picnic on a weekend, there is nowhere he can go because the areas that could be, and they were before, green areas, parks, are occupied by Israel. They live in a kind of a ghetto. Keep in mind that Israel controls 60% of the West Bank Area C completely, and the Palestinians control Area A, I mean the Palestinian Authority, which is a kind of a ghetto in 165 different bubbles or enclaves, if you like. So the feeling is that wherever you want to go, you need a permit. If you want to go abroad, you have to go through Jordan. You don't have an airport. You don't have access to the sea. They're very close to the sea, but they need permits from Israel, which they're getting once in a while in the summer vacation, to see the beach, which is 15 kilometers, 10 miles from their home. I think what sometimes comes to my mind, I know that my Jewish friends will not like it, they live in a kind of a ghetto. And we are, we the Jewish people, should be very sensitive to this feeling.
One of the things you wrote in a recent article, you quote David Makovsky, who recently joined, as you wrote, yes, Secretary of State John Kerry's negotiating team, and you have this quote from him that when in an article he published in Wall Street Journal in 2009,
yes,
the quote is, "It's foolish to believe that Israel can continue to build settlements for decades without considering the impact that has in the lives of Palestinians. The only way to deal with the settlement issue is to render it moot by widening it to peacemaking and heading straight into the final negotiations on territory." I mean, and you also have this great quote in one of your articles. It might be the same article. And I will pick up from this point, which is you have this line towards the end of the article, talk about the European Union looking at the settlements. They have discovered that this enterprise, the settlements, is a barrel of gunpowder on the lip of a volcano.
Yeah. This was my interpretation of the European way of looking at what's happening actually on the ground while we negotiate. Actually, the paradox is that the negotiations that have been, as you know, been going on since mid-80s was George Shultz and James Baker and then Oslo, of course, which is also 20 years away from us. We go to September 93. The paradox is that peace forces became a kind of a camouflage or a fig leaf for further expansion of settlements. And what when David Makovsky wrote that, you know, about this stupid policy of building settlements, which undermines the likelihood of a two-state solution, since he wrote this, there were a few thousand more settlers moved to the West Bank. And the analogy that I would make is that not so much to, Americans, the Europeans, they define the settlements as obstacle to peace. You know, when you have an obstacle, you can do a detour, you can jump over it. But I think that we are now in the center of a big minefield, and wherever you go, you are going to step on a mine and get blown up. So it's not an obstacle that you can put aside and say, well, I'll find a way to in a few years to solve this problem, because every day we are adding more mines. Instead of removing them, we are adding more and more. And this is not in my words. This is what EU reports and even the State Department reports on human rights and on the situation in the West Bank.
You wrote this piece the other day that was, at least it was posted on December the 4th, about this a Palestinian village that was taken over in 1967 on the summit of this mountain, Nebi Samwil. And I love the juxtaposition, how you talk about the wall on the one hand, but Palestinians are also being surrounded by these kind of gardens, nature gardens for the Israelis on the other. But talk a bit about that, because I mean, this is it was a very poignant piece, I thought.
Yeah, because what's happening is that Israel is looking at those areas because so much time has passed. You know, since 67, it's what, 46 years?
Right.
And we've been without the occupied territories only for 19 years. So in the mindset of most of the Israelis is that, hey, this belongs to us. We've always been there. They don't remember anything but this situation where Israel controls it. So it's like the same thing that we're doing to the Bedouins now in the Negev. I see this as the, I would call it the zero-sum game mentality. If we remove Palestinians, and I hear this from more and more Israelis, we get rid of them, we remove them, we go in, we win. Whatever we gain from them, an extra square meter we gain from the Palestinians we put in our pocket is another victory. It's the same kind of mentality, which of course is not relevant today, that we had in the 40s when the first pioneers came, and this was the ethos, you know, more dunam and more another goat. And people from the right are making this argument, and they say, hey, this is what Zionism is all about. We came, Herzl believed that he's coming to a land without people, for people without land. But this is, of course, this is wrong, because now we have a state.
So
they don't.
Here's a question I have, and it's a theme of your talk you're coming to Baltimore to give on the two-state solution.
Let's leave something to the otherwise people will not come.
That's right. No, we'll leave something. I have to ask this one quick question. Maybe we can leave it at that and then let people come.
Wonderful questions. I really enjoy it. But, you know, people, your listeners will decide it's going to be cold over there.
No. They will want to see you and hear you after this, okay. I promise. But the question I have for you that I think was put to you by some other Israeli philosopher who, and you responded to him, when you look at the 165 bubbles, when you look at the state of the West Bank and how Palestinians live in these chopped up places and the growth, the continued growth of settlements throughout the West Bank, and as you said, there's consciousness in Israel that think we own this, now called Judea and Samaria. How do you see, how can a two-state solution work like that? I mean, and how do you dismantle the settlements?
First of all, we can think about the two-state solution because there is no such a thing as a one-state solution, and there is no such a thing as a one-and-a-half-state solution, which is the case now. Israel is a full-fledged state and the Palestinian subcontractor of the Israeli occupation. I believe that it's either a Jewish state or a Palestinian state. It's not because of the both parties loaded with so much unfinished business and animosity. We need, first of all, sometimes, you know, when a couple has a problem, they decide to separate for a few years, and sometimes they decide to remarry after that or to go back and live together. And I think that what we need is a good divorce lawyer or mediator, and not a rabbi or a priest or a Muslim sheikh, to get us under the chuppah or whatever the Muslims are doing when they get married. So, first of all, the other alternatives don't exist. The other alternative is the to keep the status quo, which will lead us to apartheid. So it's either a two-state solution or apartheid or a Palestinian state, which all of them, in my view, are much worse than the price. The price of this will be much higher than the price we will have to eventually pay for this two-state solution. Now, this two-state solution, if there were no settlements around, you wouldn't be asking me this question. You ask the question because of the amount of the number of settlements and settlers that are spread everywhere, and their political power. Now, there is, I don't believe in irreversibility. Mm-hmm. We got out 8,000 families, people from Gaza. We can get 80,000 people from the West Bank. What you need is a political will, or you need to create a situation where the price tag of the status quo for the decision makers will be higher than the price of taking the risk of confrontation, perhaps with the settlements, with the settlers. And there are ideas, even we call it the Thursday 10 o'clock option, which means you tell the settlers that the last bus leaving the West Bank will leave the West Bank Thursday at 10 o'clock. if you're late, the bus will be leaving. So this is, and in my view, this option is much better than to give up the two-state solution, because giving up the two-state solution is actually giving up the Zionist idea of having both a Jewish and democratic state. You can't have both Jewish and democratic state, you know, when you have between the sea and the Jordan River, between the Mediterranean, you have less Jews than non-Jews right now, while we are talking. So we have a kind of a binational reality. It's not a binational state because the Palestinians are not part of the state, per se. And if we want to formalize it, then we kiss goodbye the Zionist idea.
I encourage all of you to meet and see Akiva Eldar Monday, 9 o'clock, December the 9th. He'll be in Baltimore at the Har Sinai Synagogue, 7:30 p.m., 2905 Walnut Avenue in Owings Mills. It's sponsored by J Street Baltimore. More information, you can email baltimore@jstreet.org. That's baltimore@jstreet.org. We'll also have this up on our website. And Akiva Eldar, look forward to meeting you when you're in Baltimore, and look forward to one day having a much longer conversation.
Thank you so much, and I promise I have much more to say.
I know you do. We're going to take a very brief break right now, so don't go away. We're back in a couple of minutes. And when we come back, we're going to bring in the latest in our series, Countdown to the Summit, looking at the issues that will be facing the 2014 Maryland General Assembly as we count down to the 2014 Annapolis Summit that you can be part of when we talk to the governor on January the 8th. And this week on Countdown to the Summit, we're going to have a debate on the minimum wage. Some folks think it should be raised, something that's bad for the economy. So stay with us. We'll tackle that right after this break. Lead Belly passed away on this day in 1949. And here's his classic and still really relevant song, Bourgeois Blues.
Don't try to buy no home down in Washington, D.C., because it's a bourgeois town. Ooh, it's a bourgeois town. I got a bourgeois blues on.